When I heard first about this company, I thought it's Italian. Pantone.
Panettone is the thing you're thinking of.
I'm not thinking about anything. I actually didn't know panettone. I was just like, oh.
Panettone is delicious.
Oh, okay. I would happily tear into a little bit of panettone right now. That would be amazing.
Oh, such a good such a good pun, Tom.
Thanks. I have my moments.
What is it with Brits and puns?
Yeah, it is definitely a thing. We like a pun-based shop name. Next time you visit, come to like a smaller town, you'll see lots of shops that are a word play. I won't bore you with some of them now, but yeah. Apologies if you don't like puns. Sorry. I'm only human.
But you should today because we talk about Pantone.
Alan, boom.
Boom. So yeah, welcome to another Business Design Teardown, where we look into darlings of design community, companies, products that designers love. Maybe not love, but use a lot today.
Yeah, love might be a stretch. <Today's>
Because we want to find out if this is just a fancy product or is it good business as well. My name is Alan. I'm a founder of the DMBA.
I'm Franz, program director at the DMBA.
And I'm Tom. I'm an independent product designer and design strategist and host of the DMBA webinar series as well. And today we are tearing down Pantone. Before we get started tearing down Pantone, not Panettone, I want you to go back in time. Yeah, I don't know if we can put like a filter on, a groovy filter, because we're going to go back to the 1960s. And Alan, Franz, you haven't got camera phones, anything like that. You are browsing for film. Do you remember that? Did you ever do photography of actual film?
Yeah.
Like film for taking pictures.
For taking pictures.
Mm-hmm. Or camera, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just about. But you're in a photography shop. You're browsing for Kodak film. Mm-hmm. Remember the brand. And the shelves are full of all these different packets. And you're looking at the Kodak ones, and there's varying shades of yellow. Some of them on the Kodak packets are like a bright, sunny yellow, and other ones are a little bit duller. Which one are you picking up?
Depending on the weather, but probably the bright one.
Exactly. Instinctively, you're more likely to opt for the most vibrant yellow, equating that sort of brightness and freshness with the freshness of the film that's inside, because fresh film matters. Film degrades over time. And if you're using an old cartridge full of film, chances of your colors being well reproduced or getting exposed properly are less. So this is a problem because the variation in the packaging color inconsistency makes people make choices about what they're going to buy. And that was happening with a brand like Kodak. People were avoiding stuff that was printed and looked a bit duller and more gravitating towards the fresh stuff. So this really was probably one of the initial reasons why color consistency started to matter in brand, because you want to reproduce the Kodak yellow exactly the same wherever you are, on every packet, in every shop front. You don't want people avoiding ones because they don't recognize it as Kodak or think it's fresh. So this was a problem because packaging color inconsistencies arrived from multiple printing companies printing things individually and not cross-referencing. So each printer that was kind of printing Kodak boxes in this Kodak yellow in different territories was using a slightly different shade of yellow due to a lack of standardized color matching process. And back in the day, this was an industry-wide problem. So it wasn't just Kodak that was having this issue of their color not being accurately reproduced. So what is the solution? Pantone is the solution. So,
of course.
But the problem is a crazy one. Just imagine, I mean, film, I get it, right? You see this kind of older looking box and you might think it's a little bit, let's say, older film, so you don't take it. But imagine this is something with food. Like, I don't know, your Coke doesn't look like the real Coke. So you're like, is somebody like trying to poison me, or what is this? Like, this trust that comes with wherever I go, the Coke red is the Coke red, or the, I don't know, Starbucks green is the Starbucks green, is so, let's say, standard that you can't even think of, I don't know, showing or looking into a shelf and then seeing that something isn't quite right, because you would think that's just not possible, that something is wrong, somebody is counterfeiting or maybe even poisoning me if this is related with food. That's weird that this, I get that this was a huge problem.
Yeah, I'm definitely like that. Like if I spot something that looks like it's been on the shelf for a while, I'm a little bit fussy of like, I'll go for like the packet that's at the back of the stack anyway. So I'm a bit weird. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You would definitely be like, is that a real product? Is it going to have some weird ingredients in it? So yeah, increasingly, I think, because we've got used to consistency, it matters more than ever that when we recognize a packet, when we recognize a brand, we instinctively recognize that exact shade. And there are so many brands, and we're going to get into them later, where color is so attached to recognition and brand and trust. So yeah, the Kodak problem was one that actually the founder of Pantone had experienced and learned about. It was one of the probably one of the little seeds that made him want to standardize and come up with the Pantone system. So who are Pantone? Why did we choose them? If you've ever worked in design, probably outside of digital, you've probably used the Pantone system. Some people mistakenly think, if they haven't kind of been in that world, that Pantone is some sort of paint or ink supplier because they're so associated with color, but they're not. They don't actually do any of the manufacturing. What they specialize in, though, is the actual color. So the standardization of color. We're going to get into how that works in a bit. So if you haven't seen a Pantone reference book before, they are these swatch books or pills or swatches full of hundreds, thousands of colors. I actually put a message out on the Slack in my building to see if anyone had a Pantone reference I could borrow. They didn't, but if you're watching this on YouTube, this is the closest I could get. Someone brought me a like matching guide. So this has got like coated, uncoated, textured papers so that you can compare the shades of these colors in the right light across, I think there's thousands of colors in there. So Pantone produce.
And the most common one is the one that looks like a handheld, like a fan thing.
Yes.
Like a deck where you can just, like almost like a deck of cards.
Yes.
You know, just
so they might be on cards and you can kind of spread them out. You can hold them up to things to see if they're a match for something. They also do these big like towers and stuff like that. But I know we're going to get into the product range a little bit later. It's basically a reference library that you can buy in all different formats. And they're ridiculously expensive, which we'll get into later. And these books become like a Bible to designers working in print or materials or fashion, and definitely brands. They are like the reference point. I have to say, researching Pantone gave me flashbacks to early in my own design career. I started off, like so many of us, kind of a real generalist. So I was doing like magazine layouts and packaging design and things like that. And I was always kind of Pantone book in hand, kind of matching things up. And who has got the only Pantone book in the studio? Has someone taken it home? That's a nightmare. Why haven't we bought
a Pantone
book? Yes, exactly.
Or has it already changed colors?
Exactly, Franz. we will get into their annoying business model a little bit later. So yeah, had real flashbacks. Thankfully, I haven't had to reference Pantone book for at least a decade and a half. Did make me slightly squirm when I was handed this one earlier today. But really, it's helping designers not only choose color schemes, but ensure that the scheme they choose is faithfully reproduced across all formats and materials. That is really the killer feature, because it's all well and good going, oh, yeah, okay, this red looks right on uncoated paper here. But if I need that exact red to be reproduced on metal or card or paper or cotton or even digital, those different materials will give a slightly different look. And actually, the color needs to be mixed or produced slightly differently for those different materials. It's amazing if you even if you've painted your home at walls at home, right, or painted a door and a skirting board with exactly the same shade, it will look different. I don't know if you've had that experience before, but it's really frustrating if you're trying to have a kind of unified scheme in your home.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the problem because we were just furnishing, and one of the decisions we had to take was basically when we had these wardrobes, we would have one material on the outside and another in the inside, but we couldn't choose the same color for inside and outside because when you open the wardrobe, actually it's a little bit darker because it doesn't have the same light. So you need to choose a different color from inside to look as if it's the same as if the outside one. And this just gave me flashback, this whole research on how many potential mistakes were in the process, because at a certain point I was given the Pantone, this deck of cards, I would call it, this reference book. And I can tell you, it was probably 5+ years old. And now, after having done this research and knowing what this means for that reference book, I'm just happy we didn't make bigger mistakes.
Indeed, yes. I'm going to hold my opinion on the whole longevity of these books until a little later on. But yeah, so Pantone doesn't sell color. They sell consistency. But what is, in detail, the Pantone matching system itself? And that's what it's called, the PMS, the Pantone matching system. So it is a standardized color reproduction system that allows for absolutely accurate communication and matching of colors across various industries. So if I tell Franz the number or the name of a color in a Pantone library over here in the UK, and he wants to get something printed in Austria, it will come out, it should come out exactly the same shade, regardless of what he prints that on. So yeah, and they have funny names. I don't know if you have seen this. I'm sure when we get into some of their marketing stuff later, they do have some hilarious names that don't seem to really bear any resemblance to the actual color. And it got me thinking, if you imagine that Pantone were creating a color palette based on an amazing podcast that helps explain business concepts to designers, what color would represent ours? I've got a few suggestions if you can't think of any off the top of your head. I do. I mean, my favorite color is like a blue teal. So we've got tear down teal.
I was going for a tear down turquoise.
Turquoise. Very good. Tongue twister. I had strategy sienna, or maybe for Alan, metrics maroon.
Okay, nice. The one that came to my mind was circular green.
Circular green, very good. Yes. Circular economy, green, excellent stuff. But yes, so how does it work? How do people identify colors in the Pantone matching system? Well, like we already said, each color in the Pantone system is identified by a unique code, such as PMS 185C. I'm sure you all know what that color is because it's so obvious from that name. It's a sort of dark red color. So that number represents a specific color and the letter indicates the color's shade or variation. So you may have 185, which is the base color, and there will be a kind of letter code that is the sort of variation depending on what it's being printed on. So every color in the system has its own unique code, and that's a sort of fingerprint. So instead of saying, I want that red, you can say, I want PMS 185C, and it will be super precise, super consistent wherever it's printed. That's the main way that you sort of interact with the Pantone books and swatches and things like that. But then how is that color formulated? Well, Pantone's color experts create these precise formulations of what the mix should be for each of those colors. So they work out what the perfect mix of inks would be for your printer, Franz, to exactly reproduce that color, whether you're presenting on paper or fabric or whatever. So although the color itself has a code, behind that code will be the mix of colors, the sort of formula that a printer would need to use to reproduce it. Because it's all well and good just having the number, you need to actually be able to mix accurately to do that. Hopefully making sense so far.
Absolutely. It is complex.
It is complex, yeah. I don't know how they keep coming up with new colors as well, but they do. So yeah, then those colors with those codes go into these color guides. Like we said, these are these little books with swatches, every color in the rainbow. And designers, like we said, studios across the world and printers will have these guides to pick their colors and make sure they match up perfectly. Worth saying at this stage that they are expensive, but I think we're going to get into that a little later. And then finally, how you use that, we've already kind of touched on this, is through using those codes to communicate the shade you need. So if I am designing, say, a new brand logo, and we're slightly adjusting the shade of blue, and we're moving from one Pantone to another, I can consult with my client and say, look at your Pantone reference. We are now moving like two shades darker, and they can talk to their people in other departments and say, this is what we're moving towards. How, you know, go and mock up some billboards or mock up some sort of brand gear or t-shirts in that color so that everyone can see how that looks. And then once we're agreed that that is the Pantone color we want to use for something, we can make sure that's in all our brand guidelines. We can communicate that to a printer, and everyone is kind of on the same page long term. So Pantone references, you'll often see them in brand guidelines. And there's usually multiple references depending on coating. You might have two or three different brand colors, and they will have a Pantone reference used for them. And then finally, once something is printed, you still need to double check that for consistency. So there is a final check that you can do using some spectrometers that kind of read the color on a material. You kind of hold these machines, these devices, up to a material, and it will tell you whether it is actually an accurate match or not for that Pantone color. So it's all well and good telling a printer this is what I want, but if they're not properly calibrated, that's a problem. So you can do some final checks to make sure it's all fully consistent. So at first it just looks like, oh yeah, it's just a load of color swatches, but actually you can see there's a lot of steps in the design process, but also in the reproduction process that goes into this. So who's the target audience for Pantone books? Unsurprisingly, it's designers, all types. This designer hasn't touched one for a very long time, but in my past, like I said, I have. I'd say mostly it tends to be kind of brand and creative agencies coming up with new identities, logo adjustments, maybe a color theme for a particular campaign that needs to be consistent across territories and across materials. But then it's used a lot in fashion as well. So, you know, if you're a big fashion house that is exploring a color trend for a year and you want to be able to reproduce that across scarves and skirts and shirts and, you know, have a real strong seasonal collection that needs to all be reasonably close as far as color is concerned, and maybe you have advertising to go with it as well that needs to match up, you would use Pantone, and you would use a reference library that shows how that's going to look on material as well as other printed campaigns in magazines and things like that. Interior designers use these a lot as well. Alan already alluded earlier to the problems that you can have if you are using Pantone on different painted surfaces, or you want to match up, say, furniture or sofa coverings with wall designs and stuff like that. So they were using it in a practical sense. But then I'd say across all brand, fashion, and interior design as well, you use Pantone as a reference for trend. We'll get into that a little bit later. But for big brands, the Pantone reference becomes critical. We talked earlier about the Kodak problem, and, you know, there are certain brands out there that you just think that is Starbucks green, that is Coca-Cola red, that is Tiffany blue, where the color is the brand. So like we said, Pantone helps you make sure that that brand is recognizable every single time, regardless of where you are. So that's what Pantone is now. a standard for the color adopted across the design industry. But how the hell does a standard like Pantone get started in the first place?
That's a classic story, how a company that actually encountered the problem turned into something that would provide a solution. Because you were talking about the problem arising for printing companies. Well, actually, Pantone was a small printing company in the 1950s. And in 1956, a person called Lawrence Herbert joined as a part-time printer. And this Lawrence Herbert actually turned the company into what it is now, Pantone. So his job as a printer was to mix colors so they would match the expectations of the clients on the final print, right? And that was hard because there was a lot of back and forth with clients, prints that had to be redone because they didn't turn out as they wanted it to, and colors that had to be mixed, or colors that were mixed in the wrong way. So we're talking about printing in the 1950s, right?
Man, that sounds like a nightmare. Yeah, I've only just, now that you're actually talking about what that would have looked like, of like someone having to mix manually and then check and probably get it a little bit wrong and probably get rejections and stuff, does sound like a bloody nightmare, to be fair.
Right. So that was the life of a printer, apparently, back then, to like mix, like have a repertoire of ingredients and mix them together to somehow match the thoughts of a client, like light blue.
Yeah. So I've had plenty of clients like that. Making them happy is tough enough without having a consistent reference.
So this mixing was hard, right? And first, Lawrence Herbert actually tried to solve this problem internally by improving the process of mixing the ink. So Pantone printed in the 1950s with about 60 different pigments, and they used these pigments to mix ink colors together. And the process to get the color right was, as we have said, super inefficient, because that was basically trial and error. So through his knowledge, he studied actually chemistry, Herbert was able to reduce the stock of pigments from 60 to 12. So he was basically able to use far fewer different inputs to mix the exact same inks and colors that they actually needed. So he became a real expert in, let's say, creating recipes for colors. So he knew exactly how he had to mix these pigments to reach the color that he actually wanted to print. So that was great for the company because that really made it easier for them in operations. But he soon realized exactly what we already discussed. That's only half of the problem. Because he knew how to mix a color doesn't mean that his clients know how to order a color, right? So there wasn't a word to say, hey, give me a light blue. There wasn't a number for this, but there was only like describing how a color should look like. And everybody has their own opinion on what's a light blue, right? So everybody would be right. And in the end, client is right. So that was still the problem of a lot of errors and a lot of ink being wasted and a lot of product, real product, printed product being or going to waste.
It's really interesting to think that you just said light blue and all three of us and probably most of the people listening are probably thinking of a slightly different color when you say light blue. It's impossible not to think of the color, and I'd be amazed if the shades, they're probably generally in a similar area. Probably quite far off at the ends of the spectrum.
Exactly. So super hard to actually read the thoughts of somebody who orders, like the client. And this problem grows with the size of the company you're working for, right? Big companies would not only buy from one printing company, but they would work with several printing companies. And because there was no standardized communication system of, I want this color, it was very likely that the prints from one printing company would look different to the prints of another printing company. And now we're back to the story that Tom told in the very beginning of Kodak, who obviously didn't intend to have two different colors for their film packaging, but they actually wanted exactly the same color. But because there was no communication system that was standardized, they tried to order the same color, but actually didn't get the same color. But there was nothing they could do about it because there was simply no standardized communication system for color. And that problem or identification of this problem actually was the birth of Pantone. So Lawrence Herbert bought the company in 1962 and introduced this Pantone color matching system in 1963. So worked there for like 5 years, got to know the industry, and I was like, look, I have identified the biggest problem of this whole industry. Let me just buy this company and change how the industry works, right?
How does a worker have enough money to buy the company?
That's an interesting one. So did you read what the buying price was?
$2 million?
Nah.
No? What was it?
$50,000.
Oh, okay.
So if you adjust this for inflation, it's $480,000 in today's money.
Still. Which is still pretty cheap for buying a company.
Yeah. So this company, so the story goes like this. This company had two divisions. The one was creating billboards, working together with clients, more agency way, and then a printing division. He was head of the printing division, which was profitable, and the owners were heading the other division, which was losing money, and they had 50,000 in debt. So he basically gave them 50,000 and got the printing division for it.
Okay, smart.
So, okay. Before we go on to tell the rest of the Pantone story, I want to discuss one question. Like, how you just said, how does a worker get this kind of money? Well, my question is, how does a worker set a standard for a completely fragmented industry? So think of the value chain in printing, right? You have a customer who is companies who order the prints. Then they might have an in-house design team or external graphic designers, agencies who work together with them. Then you have producers like the printing companies. And then you have printing company, then these printing companies have actually suppliers for machinery, paper, and ink. And now you're coming along and saying, hey, I now have a standardized communication system. Let's all, in the US in the beginning, but then all in the world, use this. So how...
That's crazy.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Like how would you do this?
It's a marketing problem. I don't think it's a product problem. It's more marketing problem. How do you get enough people to know about this to get the network effects going? So it's almost like a network effect game because you need... It's a two-sided market, a client and a... and a supplier, which in this case would be printers, not printers, but companies, yeah, producing these assets, can be print, can be something else. And probably one of those two is the leading domino. I don't know which one it is in this case.
Well, they're also, they have a mutual, or had a mutual interest in fixing this problem, I guess. You've got designers who want consistency and you've got printers who want less waste and time saving, but you're right. Yeah, I guess once a few, you said about the domino effect. Yeah, I guess once a few people start using it and saying, oh, "This is how we work," then you haven't really got another option. But Franz, I'm sure you're going to tell us how.
I love the discussion because we are getting exactly in the right direction. I was super surprised when I read this because I believe that Herbert made a genius move there. So he identified the ink producers as the stage of the value chain that have the biggest influence on the consistent outcomes of print. So after all, the core of the Pantone matching system is the translation of a color that a customer chooses into a recipe of ink. So what he did is he wrote to only 21 major ink producers, described the Pantone matching system, and offered them to license them as manufacturers of the system's basic inks. And it took less than 2 weeks for all but one of these 21 major ink producers to sign with him. So instead of going to, I don't know how many hundred thousands of designers, I don't know how many thousands of printing companies, he went to 21 ink producers and said, look, you know that the biggest problem in our industry is consistency. And this is a system where we can standardize this. And if you want, you can be part of it. And this is really the leading dominant when you think about it. So ink manufacturer sold this ink that promised to create consistent and standardized results. Printing companies were eagerly buying that because they had less trash in production and they were able to smoothly communicate with customers. And customers were happy because they could define their color once and for all and clearly communicate with designers and different production partners.
What a smart
but if you went the other way around, it's like, how?
Yeah.
Like, how do you do
so
this?
So many people to convince, like you said as well, just finding, yeah, I guess it was... So if you think about the value chain analysis that he would have done, how much would the fact that they were the smallest group that he would have to influence have affected that decision versus it's at the optimum point in the value chain? Or was it just both happened to be, it was a really beneficial coincidence that that critical part of the value chain actually had few players in it?
I didn't read much about this because a lot of the Pantone research or a lot of the Pantone stories that you read is about, well, this problem just needed solving and then everybody was happy. And then somewhere in a company history blog, I read about these 21 suppliers and this story about this. And this kind of made me think of how is this even possible in the first place to create a standard. And so I don't really know the thinking process or a bigger story around this, but it just made me think that this has to come from a deep understanding of how the value chain in this industry works.
Yeah.
And then making or thinking of a way into this value chain. Like if you have a product, now let's decouple this from Pantone. If you have a product and you want to introduce it somewhere, it's not necessarily the end user that you can target, but it might be somebody else in the value chain that helps you spread. Mm. And that was just super interesting for me because that's like a playbook example for creating network effects, as Alan said. So the more people use it, the more valuable it becomes for everybody. And entering the market through the ink producers was like genius as multipliers to reach this adoption really fast, because network effect can also be a huge enemy for you, right? So if you can't reach the critical mass so that people get value from it fast enough, people will also be like, that system doesn't help me because I know it works, but if nobody else uses it, why would I use it? And then it dies off as fast as you had the idea. But if there is a quick adoption in the beginning and you get enough people to use it in a certain amount of time, then it's like a ball rolling down the hill.
Yeah.
It is also one of the reasons why Pantone might happen again.
Yeah, it will.
It's one of the reasons why Pantone is so hard to disrupt. During my research, I started thinking, because we will get also to the problems with Pantone and their system, which there are a few. So I started thinking, yeah, why is no one else competing with them? And this is the reason. The reason is, it's so hard to disrupt someone who has such a deep embedded position in this market, because everyone is used to using this standard. That's why it's standard.
Mm.
It's so hard to make everyone now move from this standard to another one. They have licenses with software. Everyone has their books. Everyone knows how to use the language. And that's like not just important for setup of the business, but it's also important for the longevity of this business.
Yeah, definitely. Alrighty, moving on in the company history. So Now it's still the 1960s, right? Pantone is focusing. Thanks, Tom.
You've got Panettone on the brain. Get this man a slice of Panettone.
So, Pantone is focusing on the printing industry, right? They're coming from the printing industry. They know how that this is the solution for the problem of the printing industry. And now we're talking about printing on paper, right? As we see with many companies, the early focus of the company is product innovation. So perfecting the recipe for different surfaces. And this is also something that Tom already mentioned. If you use the exact same paint on different materials, it will look different. So what Pantone did was defining slightly different formulas so that the colors would look identical on different materials. So you'd have for one color, for one Pantone fingerprint color, you would have a cardboard formula that would be adjusted to the matte, absorbent, slightly textured surface. And then you would have a magazine color, basically the other way around, for the shiny and really, really smooth material. So that's the whole real deep dive that Pantone did at this point in time, perfecting this for printing on any form of paper, shiny, matte, cardboard. And product innovation actually stayed at the core for Pantone for a very long time. Eventually, Herbert actually sees growth potential beyond printing on paper. So in the 1970s and then in the 1980s, Pantone went from printing to dyeing, for example, textiles, and also into coating, for example, plastics. So it allowed them to expand from graphic designers and everything that's done on paper to industrial design, to interior design, to fashion design, because it's now also about optimizing these formulas, not only for printing on paper, but optimizing color formulas for dyeing, optimizing color formulas for coating. And next step, 1990s and 2000s, we are in the emergence of digital platforms, right? Pantone, this could have easily been a, let's say, story of a company that dies because we are now in the digital age and we don't need this as much anymore. But actually, Pantone made a nice and a good transition into integrating into digital platforms. They were adapting to they had now calimetric system also for digital workflows and how you could actually achieve the same color result, not only when you print, but also when you have different kinds of displays.
I remember having the Pantone references in Photoshop.
Yeah.
When that was a design tool for me. Are you going to talk about the Adobe situation with Pantone later?
We're going to talk about it now, because until now, we still haven't talked about how exactly they make money, right? So by now, we have this Pantone color matching system. And now it contains about, 2,000-something individual colors and 10,000 full when you actually add all the shades and tints and
all variations.
All variations, exactly. So every color has a number, and depending on that number, you can translate that into every application's language. So printing, dyeing, digital screens. And this is what the product is, right? So it's not the color itself, but it's the intellectual property of matching a color that you see on one of their color fans, swatches, to how an application industry has to use it so it looks exactly the same irrespectively from where it's used. And that's now the interesting question of how do you even make money if you don't produce anything in this printing value chain. Let's have a look, or let's think about the value chain again. They are not selling printing machines. They are not selling ink. They are not selling printers itself. They are not printing anything. They don't even own, nobody can own a color. But still, they're making money in this industry. And the most money that they make comes from producing these books. Like these watches that you need to buy for $700, for $1,000, for $5,000, depending on the...
They range from $200,
yeah,
which is the essential kit, which gives you the basic 2,390 spot colors, all the way up to $9,000, which is the tower
of colors.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like...
Which is printed in plastic.
You just pull them all out, yeah, and compare them and everything. God.
Right?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
what you're buying basically is a physical book, fan, swatch collection that comes together with the, let's say, dictionary that translates this one color that you see into a Pantone code, into a hex code, into a code for how to mix ink or color for printing. And now it also makes sense to enter new industries where you need to adjust this information for different surfaces. Now it makes sense to increase the number of standardized colors because then you can sell new swatch books. Now it makes sense to just have different variations and be in different industries so you can sell more of these physical color palettes. And then it also makes sense to ride the horse of, hey, we are selling consistency, and if you actually value consistency, then you better buy one of these books a year because your book is going to be exposed to oxygen exposed to oils, UV radiation, and next year your color will not be the same anymore. So you better buy a new one. For
unbelievable.
When I heard this for the first time, I thought like, oh, this is laughable. Of course, it's the same. You know, like even if this is 3 years old, I should be able to see the right color. But I've seen some really old ones, and then you see how it deteriorates. But also, I read some reviews. I don't know if you've seen those on YouTube and on other websites. And it seems to be a much bigger problem. So there was a person working for an ink manufacturer, and he's basically, or she's writing, or them, that they had to come up with their own system of standardizing Pantone colors because every book is different. And they say, customers order a specific color, we would match it to our book, and they would complain. We would compare our book to theirs, and they would be completely different. We would have to start adding their job name to the color number and make it a custom match, save it, and blah, 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 blah. All because different books having different colors. So what the client is seeing and what the producer is seeing is different. It just sounds ridiculous.
It does sound pretty mad. But they do degrade. The first design studio I worked for did not upgrade its Pantone books terribly regularly. I'd say like 3 to 4 years they would eke out of those. And yeah, you start to lose confidence in it as well, which isn't great. I was just going to jump in when you were talking about the matching system, that people might be listening to this thinking, can't you just use hex colors and CMYK and RGB, because you mentioned that, you know, it converts to those things. And of course you could, but we've already said the USP is the different formula for the different surfaces. Yeah. That's the bit that we have to remember, because yes, you could definitely match on screen a Pantone reference to a CMYK mix, but you would have to adjust that CMYK or that RGB or that hex for all those different materials that you might be using it on. And that's when it starts to get very complicated.
Exactly. When you're talking to another designer on screen, obviously no need to use Pantone, right? But if at a certain point something needs to be coded, a physical product, a chair needs to be coated based on specific color, you will have to somehow translate the color that you see on a screen or that you choose on a from a mood board into how it actually looks like when you print it.
When Alan is painting his new sitting room tear down teal, he wants to make sure it matches his t-shirts and, you know, the DMBA website.
There is a that project that we had to kill it in the DMBA, where we wanted to create socks. So we wanted to create
merch
on brand socks using merch. Our colors. And it took us a few months to realize that, yeah, it's going to be very, very hard to find exact brand colors in the materials that we would need for socks. And because everything we did just came out completely different. So we just dropped the project because it didn't look like the NBA brand. By the way, I came across another really interesting quote regarding this problem with oxidization. So one of the people said, my teacher used to keep hers, so Pantone matching book, keep hers in a Ziploc bag only to bring it out when most needed. Otherwise, she kept it in a dark room and it preserved it pretty well.
Yeah, that's what you'd have to do. You'd have to keep it in a vacuum.
Yeah.
In a dark room.
Okay, so now we know, and Alan will go into numbers a little bit more later, but now we know that half of company's revenue comes from physical swatch books. And then now we're getting into what Tom just said. Part of the revenue also comes from licensing to digital products. And yes, you might have realized, if you are a designer who worked with Pantone palette in Photoshop or in any other Adobe tool, that it was part of it for free and now it's not anymore. So before, it was Adobe paying the licensing fees so it would integrate Pantone color deck into their product. They decided for some reason, or maybe obvious reason, to not do that anymore. So now if you want to use Pantone palette in any Adobe product, you need to pay, what, $15 a month to have access to that?
I think it goes up to 22, yeah. Or something like that.
I think it's 15 per month or 7.5 per year. I mean, 7.5 times 12 per year, which is 50% cheaper. So 80 per year or...
Which isn't crazy, but that adds up if you've got a lot of designers in your studios and stuff.
Yeah. So, now we have talked about initial problem that they solved, how they focused on product and product innovation to enter new industries and also kept up with digitalization, even though they originated in the printing era. So for me, that's still... an interesting one. But the reason why Pantone is so well known by now goes beyond product innovation and also goes beyond all this translation system that we have just described for the last, I don't know, 40 minutes. So it was super important and also interesting to understand how they got to the point where they were the industry standard. But now... it feels like Pantone isn't only the industry standard, but it's something more. It's like a brand that stands for something, a company that has certain aesthetics, and it's not, let's say, a technology enabler anymore.
It's also definitely more recognizable outside of design. Like you said, you don't have to be a technical person to recognize Pantone, the brand and various products.
Yeah, it's true. So I think what happened is that they realized that even if they cannot own a specific color, they could become synonymous for color in general. At least it feels like that's what they are trying to do. So the first initiative that went into this direction of getting this authority in color was the foundation of the Pantone Color Institute in 1986. So that's quite early already. And until then, Pantone was more a technology enabler, right? It made something possible that was ideated and decided by somebody else, right? So somebody, some creatives chose colors, created great designs, and then somebody printed or produced something beautiful. And Pantone was more in the background enabling all of this. The Pantone Color Institute was intended to be a color consultancy and a trend forecasting body, and they wanted to become this authority in color, something that would not only make it possible to print well what you intended, but actually something that would go ahead of a trend and go ahead in an industry. So over the years, they embraced this thought of authority building more and more, and actually got quite bold with what they did beyond their core business. So first, this Pantone Color Institute is now an agency that you can hire to create new colors. So you can say, well, I need something that should communicate this, or my brand is that, and you should help me to get the perfect color for this. For example, Universal Studios approached them to create yellow for their Minions franchise, the banana yellow.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, because again, it's got to be same yellow of the characters, yellow on the billboards, toys, plushies, all that stuff, right? You need it to all feel the same.
I think that's one reason, but I think the even more important reason is that you position Pantone now not only as the body or product that can make it look the same everywhere, but you want to be the company that also says, and it should be this color. So choosing the color before, they were like making the color happen that somebody else decided on. But now they are trying to move into a corner or an authority that they are the ones owning color, choosing color, setting trends. And yeah, that's what they do with a lot of brands. Like every brand can go to Pantone and work with them together on creating a new color. And obviously they cannot own the color, but it's still something that they help in creation, and then obviously also in
operational
operationalizing. Thank you, Tom. Pantone.
Pantone. I think it's ironic that we're talking about consistency of this brand, and we've pronounced Pantone five different ways so far.
That's true.
It's sweet. They're super fascinating how they've moved into that, into being an authority brand. I think that's like smart. And that a lot of the headlines are around, a lot of the stuff is around them coming up with new colors for like Minions or a new brand or something like that. But they're actually also, it's a really good service to be able to say, we have this brand color, but we need to kind of consolidate. We are still having those consistency issues. So, go to someone like Pantone and say, this is our brand, we need to make sure it's reproduced everywhere really well, help us like nail that, get the mix right, get all the formulas right.
Yep.
So on one hand they're like going, it should be yellow, and the other hand they're going, your yellows are a little bit off, let's get it all nightly nice tightly packaged. And I think they did that with Tiffany, you know what. That is a brand that is synonymous with their blue.
Yeah,
I think they did an activation around that, like, you know, being like the Tiffany color people, like all the various swatches and books and everything. And kind of made a thing of that when Tiffany and Pantone worked together. Clever move.
Cool thing is that that's still kind of the obvious thing to do, right? So you know something really well, so let's also become an agency or a consultant in that. Right. So that's like no brainer in a way. But the interesting thing is that they got bolder and bolder with this approach of venturing out of their core business to build this authority. So they partnered up with companies to launch actual real products like a lipstick with cosmetics brand Sephora. They opened a hotel in Brussels, which doesn't exist anymore, but also interesting decision. So,
but why? I mean, why would they go into lipstick and hotel? Like, what's their additional value apart from choosing a color for both of these products? I don't get it.
I think it was being synonymous with aesthetics, being synonymous with something that looks beautiful and appealing. So this is why you go into lipstick and cosmetic and you use a brand that's actually also high profile. This is why you open a hotel and these rooms are exactly the opposite of the white, sterile boxes, but beautiful color schemes. This is a weird decision, so I'm just trying to make this up because I think they agree now because Pantone Hotel isn't there anymore.
Hey, but just imagine how the hotel rooms had to be numbered in Pantone, hey. Pantone Hotel. 9,243.
I didn't see that. I really hope that like each room, everything in the room was the same color. That would be so trippy.
I had a look at this edit today, and now it's the successor of the Pantone Hotel.
I've got to look it up.
And it doesn't give me a Pantone vibe anymore at all. But I kind of can imagine how a hotel could look like if it was a Pantone hotel. And now when you have a look at the website, they even have merch. So, and that's actually kind of interesting and minimalistic. It's still weird because it's proper merch, like it's a mug and it's a keychain and it's an umbrella. So it's not really this, let's say, high profile goods like a lipstick. But when you look at it, it's still kind of a nice, minimalistic, one simple color version of this. So it still feels interesting to me.
I think, my understanding was lipstick is like the shades become so famous and people really, really like gravitate to their specific shade. Like that is my lippy. That I can understand that actually that connection to a number or to a Pantone shade kind of works there because a lot of people see that as part of their personality. Yeah, that is interesting. I can see why that was something worth exploring. I've just looked at the Pantone Hotel. It's too colourful.
Too many different colours.
Colourful.
Right?
It looks like a ball pit. Not for me. I'm not surprised it closed down.
Cool.
But the Pantone mugs, they're still everywhere. Like you go to like sort of gift shops and stationery shops and everything. They're always there, aren't they? They've become. There's one in every office cupboard. There's a few here, which I was going to borrow for the podcast, but they're actually people's mugs. And I was like, they're going to get angry with me on Slack. So I didn't borrow them. But yeah, they did branch out a lot.
But biggest coup when it comes to moving into being an authority in color was in 2000 when they, for the first time, presented the color of the year. So instead of explaining what color of the year is, I'm going to read the official press statement for the color of the year 2024, Peach Fuzz. A light, delicate shade that sits between pink and orange, Peach Fuzz marks the 25th anniversary of Pantone's Color of the Year program. This soft, heartfelt hue expresses the desire to nurture kindness, compassion, and connection, all while fostering a deep coziness as we seek a peaceful future.
No,
couldn't have said it better myself.
You already get a sense for what Color of the Year is, right? So this is a presentation of 30 minutes of one color and why it is the color of the year. So the whole point of this thing is to make not only designers, but the whole world or as many people as possible speak about color and the importance of color and what color can stand for, what color can be at least once a year.
And to sell more books.
Exactly.
Because the new...
And to sell more books.
New, the new color is only in the... Oh, you guessed it. The new book.
Yeah. Peach Fuzz is nice, by the way. Like, I really like it. I think I've got shade very close to that in my home office.
And if you want, Tom, there is already a lipstick. I checked it out. Yeah.
Is there? Perfect. I shall wear it the next one.
Mm. It does remind me of my favorite ice cream.
Which is?
Flavor.
Peach something?
I don't know. Peach fuzz. Yeah, probably peach, yeah.
Love peaches. Love fuzz.
So for me, this is a real interesting story from like becoming or solving a real technological problem and solving a real like, yeah, being a tech enabler to now still being the same thing and still making most of my money from this IP of translating colors and selling physical books to now really trying or even succeeding to be this authority in color, even though let's say not everybody is a huge fan of Pantone, right? So until now we have talked about it quite positively. I was quite positively surprised because I'm really interested in all of what I was talking about, like how do you solve an industry's problem? How do you convince an industry to become a standard and so on? But now it seems like people are not as fond anymore of Pantone, partly because they are even not as clear cut when it comes to what they own and what they don't own, but rather just sue people who try to do similar things as they are.
Yeah. It's on, I think one of the groups that are not a big fan are anyone who is doing lots of forward planning for their color schemes and has done all of that and then color of the year comes out. So I don't think we can underestimate what a big deal color of the year is now. Like it makes mainstream news typically, and it truly is a big trend driver. You will be seeing that shade for the next 2 to 3 years. This isn't Pantone looking back reflectively and saying this was the color of the year and like aggregating something that's gone. This is setting direction. And that's massive. And you look back at color of the year and then you look back at fashion, interior design, brand design the following years, it does influence it. For better or worse. And I think that's one of those areas where people are uncomfortable. There's stories of like interiors companies who have planned out their color schemes for the next couple of years and then color of the year comes out and they're like, shit, okay. Time to rethink at least some of what we're doing in response to that. So
because that color is now owned by Pantone, right? So that which is not possible, color. But still somehow it's how they act and sometimes even, what they try to enforce when it comes to competing systems or other ways to define or standardize colors.
I also had a look at the last 25 colors of the year. So starting 2000 to 2024, I think there's 25 colors, if I'm not mistaken. And I was also surprised to see just seeing certain colors in certain years where I did, from my memory, remember noticing more of that, like vibrant yellow, that kind of shade.
The yellow stood out to me, that kind of bright mustardy kind of thing. I mean, I've worn more of that, and subconsciously, you know, it's been everywhere, and it's been color of the year. I think it was just coming out of the pandemic. It was kind of connected to
2021,
getting people outside more and positivity. There was a message and a story to it.
Yeah, eliminating an ultimate gray, I think. Yeah, that was the name of that color. Yeah, that one was really big hit. And also 2019, Living Coral, I think I can just kind of remember seeing that afterwards. And then if you go back all the way to 2000, you can see, just completely different colors, which are not modern anymore. So it does speak to the power of the company in terms of their importance of the, in this industry. And of course, as a numbers person, I was interested to know, yeah, being such an important company in this industry, how much money are you making?
And how much money are they making?
So, Franz and Tom, I'm sad to disclose that the company is, well, it's not private, but it's part of a bigger group, so you can't really find the numbers. Right. So as it's part of a company that owns 10 brands, they don't report how much money Pantone is actually making. But I wouldn't be here talking about this if I wouldn't have tried.
Oh, I thought you were about to go. So I'm on to the next.
So sorry, folks.
Easy research for Alan.
And that was it with today's episode.
Exactly. So I did what I love doing, which is just using proxy numbers and certain estimates to come up with my guess with a high degree of certainty, let's say 90%, that Pantone or Pantone is making somewhere around 100 and 200 million. So my guess is actually $150 million per year. Okay, so here is why. Here is how I came up with this number, which I think is more important and interesting, the process itself, than the actual number. So basically, my process started in 2012, or that's the first data point that I'm going to use. Because
you've been working on these numbers since 2012.
Exactly, yeah. Since I was born, I loved playing like playing with numbers like this, Tom. So actually, in 2012... Pantone and the company that owned Pantone, which is called X-Rite, were acquired by $625 million. Okay. And at that time, X-Rite and Pantone were public. So I could check what the revenue number for 2012 was, which is $250 million. But that doesn't say what percentage of that was X-Rite and Pantone. But what we have now is so-called revenue multiple. So the company making $250 million revenue was sold for $625 million, which means that they were sold for 2.5x, right? So that was the revenue multiple. What we also know is that in 2007, Pantone was acquired by X-Rite for $180 million. And that would put Pantone's revenue in 2007 at $70 million. Okay, but how do we know what the current number is? Well, another data point I could find in the X-Rite's annual report for that year, for the end of 2022, was that their standards business, and the standards business is essentially Pantone business, was growing at 5% annually. So, since this company is not, it's pretty stable, I would say, I just took this assumption and basically looked at the compound and growth. So if a company that had $70 million in 2007 and was growing steadily at 5% a year, basically that would put a company at $150 million mark today. That's one part of the process. Another part of the process is once I had this number, I was then just double checking with some other numbers I could find. So one of the things you can do for any company is go on LinkedIn and figure out how many employees they have, at least on LinkedIn. And since this is a US company, I think that number is pretty close to the correct one. And at this moment, so we are recording this in March 2024, Pantone has roughly 350 employees on LinkedIn. Right. And then I had a look at some other companies which have roughly the same size of the company, so in terms of the employees, and just try to see, does that match? You know, do those companies also have revenue somewhere between 100 and 200 million? And if you look into technology sector, the companies with 350 employees have roughly 50 to 200 million revenue. If we look into consulting and professional services, it's usually between 30 and 150 million. And if you look into manufacturing, it's usually between 20 and 100 million. in revenue. So yeah, that does confirm that this seems like a realistic number. So somewhere between 100 and 200 million. And another number I could find is that the parent company, so the company that currently owns Pantone brand, which basically owns 10 brands at the same time, has 5 billion in revenue in total, which just gives me that, which just tells me that, yeah, if each of those brands would be making the same revenue, each of them would be making 500 million. So 150 to 200 million is in the realistic range for Pantone, considering everything I just explained. But to put this into further perspective, what other company that maybe we're all familiar with is somewhere in that ballpark? Evernote. So Evernote has roughly 150 million, somewhere between 100 and 200 million in revenue. So that kind of explains that, yeah, Pantone has a super valuable position in the market, but it's much smaller than some of the other, or I think all the other companies we have covered so far in this teardown format. And that makes it really interesting, like a small giant in a way, you know.
Feels a bit like Helvetica, which, you know, again, another one of those design process brands that we talked about that is just ubiquitous, and people do know it outside of design as well, but actually revenue small relative to the impact that it has.
Exactly. Yeah. Unfortunately, since this is a private company, I couldn't find any other really big numbers apart from what Francie already shared, which is 50% of this revenue coming from selling the color guides and 50% coming from consulting and digital services such as Pantone Connect, which I have a note here, yeah, costs $90 a year or $15 per month.
Mm. This Pantone Connect is the thing that you use in Adobe.
In Adobe, and I believe also some other apps as well. Yeah. So yeah, so now that we cover all of that, that we learned about Pantone business strategy, story, value position, and numbers, how do we feel about it? Buying, holding, selling. And again, as always, this is not investment advice. You could buy the parent company, but you cannot buy directly Pantone. But just showing our sentiment towards the brand.
If you buy a Pantone book, just don't hold it too much, because the oils will fuck it up. It's hard not to use my heart for this one and be like, not a big Pantone guy. I just feel like it's so rife for someone to come and offer an alternative, which is much, much cheaper. I'm amazed that hasn't broken through. I know a few people have tried, like there's kind of dodgy sounding, similar named sort of open source color matching things that have tried to break through. But yeah, it doesn't feel rife for growth. I guess they could play around with business model a bit. I feel like a subscription for these bloody books would probably be quite a viable business model for some people, because they're so expensive to keep buying. But yeah, just, I don't think I would be buying. Just, I don't think you'd be getting mad returns. And I don't know, I'm not mad about a monopoly on color and process in any industry, let alone my industry, Pantone. So it's a no from me.
So selling.
Not even buying in the first place, Alan.
Yeah, I agree with you, Tom, in this case. I would sell. We are already a global standard. I don't know. It feels like we have plateaued. And
Where would you grow, right? There's no... Usually we say, yeah, just go to China, just go to Asia, you can grow there. But Pantone is already everywhere.
Pantone is the standard. Let's not say
it's not.
And it feels like they are more fighting a fighting for relevance rather than solving nowadays problems.
Hmm. Yeah. You can imagine, like, in their origin and heyday, it was a massive breakthrough, right? But now you just think, where does it go next? Does it keep doing these interesting brand activations and partnerships? And I don't know. I think the broader industry's response to color of the year is increasingly frustrated, I think, in some quarters. So, yeah, I don't know. It doesn't feel like it's going to be big breakthroughs for Pantone, but, you know. And no reason. That I don't think they've proved otherwise for quite a while now. You know, color of the year was has been interesting, yeah. But, yeah.
And now I'm going to buzzword. Hey, let's just create these books and sell it for nothing and then have an AI that knows how to mix the right color paired with a hardware piece that measures the input.
Man, I'd be amazed.
Let's just do it.
Shitting themselves about stuff like
that. That's investment advice. If you have spare time invested in this product idea.
Yeah.
Indeed. I'd be curious if I would be surprised if this isn't an industry that you can at least, yeah, we have been talking about standards, right? And dominant design and network effects. So yes, there is still something that defends them, but I don't think it's going to last for too long.
The one thing I would say, sorry, Alan.
Ooh, I was just wrong this now, Tom and me.
I do think there's an awful lot of brand equity built up that a competitor would find it hard to break into. So yeah, I think we've touched on this already. This isn't like some breakthrough learning from me. But I think if you are a high-end design studio or a design studio full stop, saying that you use Pantone and therefore you invest in buying books every year and consistency and that matters to you, I think it's just a real signal of quality and attention to detail that I'm not sure. I don't know. I feel like it would take a long time for another player to be taken seriously. There is something about Pantone, it feels kind of high end in the design world. I know there's no alternative, but somehow they've positioned themselves as high.
That was the last step that we were talking about in this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right. That authority thing. And because I was trying to imagine, you know, some sort of free AI breakthrough one. And I don't know. There is a sort of, there's something about saying that you're going to be using Pantone and having a Pantone number associated with your brand that has a sort of certain cachet that might be hard to reproduce. It's that sort of X factor kind of thing. Yeah.
Alan, tell us your
Alan,
verdict.
Sorry.
No, I do share your both of these views. So like not being excited, but at the same time, having the feeling that it's not going anywhere. The brand is not. So that's why I'm somewhere in between hold and sell. Not super optimistic. I don't see a lot of room for growth, but at the same time, hard to disrupt them. With a lot of these stories, what it comes down to is a huge technological innovation. AI was mentioned, and this could be it. It could also be a huge change in customer preferences, or it just could be that we live more and more in the digital world, and there, this system is less important. So imagine if we would be going out and, you know, being exposed to physical materials outside less and less. It's a bit of a dark thought, but still, I mean, in this kind of world where everybody's wearing Apple Vision Pro, yeah, you need less Pantone because even the headset itself could help with calibrating colors outside. So yeah, I'm also not super positive. It's amazing what they've built. It's really, really interesting and unique story because they've made they're basically selling consistency. They're selling, it's a service, but they've just done a beautiful job in packaging it. They solve the real need, but it feels like time is ticking for them.
Does, doesn't it? There's threats in few areas there. And it's not to say, you know, we talked about there's not a lot of headroom maybe for growth and breakthroughs and stuff. It's not to say it's a bad business, right? Like, that's not it. But yeah, I did find it, I think, as a story of building a system, and I really liked what you talked about earlier about the value chain, how critical that was. That's the big lesson for me from this one. That discovery, that breakthrough.
When you said it's probably a good business, we didn't talk about profitability because obviously you can't find numbers on it. But let's put this in perspective. When you buy a hardcover book, even the one with photos, it usually costs, what is the maximum price? I don't know, $30, $40, maybe $50. And here you're buying, it's not even a full book. It's, you know, that, how do you call it? You two call it Swatch.
Swatch book.
Yeah. $250 for that. You can just imagine what the actual production price is, but I'm guessing it's a huge, huge markup. So yeah, it is probably a fantastic business at this stage still.
Mm. Yeah.
And on that note, it's time to close. No, seriously, do you have any other stuff, Tom Friend?
We have fantastic business information for you if you're interested in taking a mini MBA.
Exactly, Franz. Go ahead.
I don't know the link by heart. Alan, do it.
So if you enjoyed this episode and if you're interested in this intersection of business and design, you will definitely also enjoy our mini MBA, which is essentially a 7-day email course where designers are taught business skills relevant for, well, design work. It's totally free and you can sign up at d.mba/mini-mba. Franz, so d.mba/mini-mba. So remember this for next time.
I will.
Cool.
Thanks.
Thank you. See you in the next one. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.